This is Audible.
Art and Fear. Observations on the Perils and Rewards of Art Making. By David Bales and Ted Orland. Narrated by Arthur Morey. Copyright 1993 by David Bales and Ted Orland. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Image Continuum Press, and was produced in the year 2012 by Tantor Media, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Introduction. This is a book about making art. Ordinary art. Ordinary art means something like all art not made by Mozart. After all, art is rarely made by Mozart-like people. Essentially, statistically speaking, there aren't any people like that. But while geniuses may get made once a century or so, good art gets made all the time. Making art is a common and intimately human activity, filled with all the perils and rewards that accompany any worthwhile effort. The difficulties art makers face are not remote and heroic, but universal and familiar. This, then, is a book for the rest of us. Both authors are working artists, grappling daily with the problems of making art in the real world. The observations we make here are drawn from personal experience and relate more closely to the needs of artists than to the interests of viewers. This book is about what it feels like to sit in your studio or classroom, at your wheel or keyboard, easel or camera, trying to do the work you need to do. It is about committing your future to your own hands, placing free will above predestination, choice above chance. It is about finding your own work. David Bales and Ted Orland. Part 1. Writing is easy. All you do is sit staring at a blank sheet of paper until the drops of blood form on your forehead. Gene Fowler. 1. The nature of the problem. Life is short, art long, opportunity fleeting, experience treacherous, judgment difficult. Hippocrates, 460 to 400 B.C. Making art is difficult. We leave drawings unfinished and stories unwritten. We do work that does not feel like our own. We repeat ourselves. We stop before we have mastered our materials, or continue on long after their potential is exhausted. Often the work we have not done seems more real in our minds than the pieces we have completed. And so questions arise, how does art get done? Why, often, does it not get done? And what is the nature of the difficulties that stop so many who start? These questions, which seem so timeless, may actually be particular to our age. It may have been easier to paint bison on the cave walls long ago than to write this or any other sentence today. Other people in other times and places had some robust institutions to shore them up. Witness the church, the clan, ritual, tradition. It's easy to imagine that artists doubted their calling less when working in the service of God than when working in the service of self. Not so today. Today, almost no one feels shored up. Today, artwork does not emerge from a secure common ground. The bison on the wall is someone else's magic. Making art now means working in the face of uncertainty. It means living with doubt and contradiction, doing something no one much cares whether you do, and for which there may be neither audience nor reward. Making the work you want to make means setting aside these doubts so that you may see clearly what you have done, and thereby see where to go next. Making the work you want to make means finding nourishment within the work itself. This is not the age of faith, truth, and certainty. Yet even the notion that you have a say in this process conflicts with the prevailing view of art making today, namely that art rests fundamentally upon talent, and that talent is a gift randomly built into some people and not into others. In common parlance, either you have it or you don't. Great art is a product of genius, good art a product of near genius. which Nabokov likened to near beer, and so on down the line to pulp romances and paint by the numbers. This view is inherently fatalistic. Even if it's true, it's fatalistic, and offers no useful encouragement to those who would make art. Personally, we'll side with Conrad's view of fatalism, namely that it is a species of fear, the fear that your fate is in your own hands, but that your hands are weak. But while talent, not to mention fate, luck, and tragedy, all play their role in human destiny, they hardly rank as dependable tools for advancing your own art on a day-to-day basis. Here in the day-to-day world, which is, after all, the only one we live in, the job of getting on with your work turns upon making some basic assumptions about human nature, assumptions that place the power, and hence the responsibility, for your actions in your own hands. Some of these can be stated directly. A few assumptions. Art making involves skills that can be learned. The conventional wisdom here is that while craft can be taught, art remains a magical gift bestowed only by the gods. Not so. In large measure, becoming an artist consists of learning to accept yourself, which makes your work personal, and in following your own voice, which makes your work distinctive. Clearly, these qualities can be nurtured by others. Even talent is rarely distinguishable, over the long run, from perseverance and lots of hard work. It's true that every few years the authors encounter some beginning photography student whose first semester prints appear as finely crafted as any Ansel Adams might have made. And it's true that a natural gift like that, especially coming at the fragile early learning stage, returns priceless encouragement to its maker. But all that has nothing to do with artistic content. Rather, it simply points up the fact that most of us, including Adams himself, had to work years to perfect our art. Art is made by ordinary people. Creatures having only virtues can hardly be imagined making art. It's difficult to picture the Virgin Mary painting landscapes, or Batman throwing pots. The flawless creature wouldn't need to make art, and so, ironically, the ideal artist is scarcely a theoretical figure at all. If art is made by ordinary people, then you'd have to allow that the ideal artist would be an ordinary person, too, with the whole usual mixed bag of traits that real human beings possess. This is a giant hint about art, because it suggests that our flaws and weaknesses, while often obstacles to our getting work done, are a source of strength as well. Something about making art has to do with overcoming things, giving us a clear opportunity for doing things in ways we have always known we should do them. Making art and viewing art are different at their core. The sane human being is satisfied that the best he or she can do at any given moment is the best he or she can do at any given moment. That belief, if widely embraced, would make this book unnecessary, false, or both. Such sanity is, unfortunately, rare. Making art provides uncomfortably accurate feedback about the gap that inevitably exists between what you intended to do and what you did. In fact, if art making did not tell you, the maker, so enormously much about yourself, then making art that matters to you would be impossible. To all viewers but yourself, what matters is the product, the finished artwork. To you and you alone, what matters is the process, the experience of shaping that artwork. The viewer's concerns are not your concerns, although it's dangerously easy to adopt their attitudes. Their job is whatever it is, to be moved by art, to be entertained by it, to make a killing off it, whatever. Your job is to learn to work on your work. For the artist, that truth highlights a familiar and predictable corollary. Art making can be a rather lonely, thankless affair. Virtually all artists spend some of their time, and some artists spend virtually all of their time, producing work that no one else much cares about. It just seems to come with the territory. But for some reason, self-defense perhaps, Artists find it tempting to romanticize this lack of response, often by, heroically, picturing themselves peering deeply into the underlying nature of things long before anyone else has eyes to follow. Romantic, but wrong. The sobering truth is that the disinterest of others hardly ever reflects a gulf in vision. In fact, there's generally no good reason why others should care about most of any one artist's work. The function of the overwhelming majority of your artwork is simply to teach you how to make the small fraction of your artwork that soars. One of the basic and difficult lessons every artist must learn is that even the failed pieces are essential. X-rays of famous paintings reveal that even master artists sometimes made basic mid-course corrections, or deleted really dumb mistakes, by overpainting the still-wet canvas. The point is that you learn how to make your work by making your work. And a great many of the pieces you make along the way will never stand out as finished art. The best you can do is make art you care about, and lots of it. The rest is largely a matter of perseverance. Of course, once you're famous, collectors and academics will circle back in droves to claim credit for spotting evidence of genius in every early piece. But until your ship comes in, the only people who will really care about your work are those who care about you personally. Those close to you know that making the work is essential to your well-being. They will always care about your work, if not because it is great, then because it is yours. And this is something to be genuinely thankful for. Yet, however much they love you, it still remains as true for them as for the rest of the world. Learning to make your work is not their problem. Art making has been around longer than the art establishment. Through most of history, the people who make art never thought of themselves as making art. In fact, it's quite presumable that art was being made long before the rise of consciousness, long before the pronoun I was ever employed. The painters of caves, quite apart from not thinking of themselves as artists, probably never thought of themselves at all. What this suggests, among other things, is that the current view equating art with self-expression reveals more a contemporary bias in our thinking than an underlying trait of the medium. Even the separation of art from craft is largely a post-Renaissance concept, and more recent still is the notion that art transcends what you do and represents what you are. In the past few centuries, Western art has moved from unsigned tableaus of orthodox religious scenes to one-person displays of personal cosmologies. Artist has gradually become a form of identity which, as every artist knows, often carries with it as many drawbacks as benefits. Consider that if artist equals self, then when, inevitably, you make flawed art, you are a flawed person. And when, worse yet, you make no art, you are no person at all. It seems far healthier to sidestep that vicious spiral by accepting many paths to successful art making, from reclusive to flamboyant, intuitive to intellectual, folk art to fine art. One of those paths is yours. 2. Art and fear. Artists don't get down to work until the pain of working is exceeded by the pain of not working. Stephen de Stabler. Those who would make art might well begin by reflecting on the fate of those who preceded them. Most who began, quit. It's a genuine tragedy. Worse yet, it's an unnecessary tragedy. After all, artists who continue and artists who quit share an immense field of common emotional ground. Viewed from the outside, in fact, they're indistinguishable. We're all subject to a familiar and universal progression of human troubles, troubles we routinely survive, but which are, oddly enough, routinely fatal to the art-making process. To survive as an artist requires confronting these troubles. Basically, those who continue to make art are those who have learned how to continue, or more precisely, have learned how not to quit. But curiously, while artists always have a myriad of reasons to quit, They consistently wait for a handful of specific moments to quit. Artists quit when they convince themselves that their next effort is already doomed to fail. And artists quit when they lose the destination for their work, for the place their work belongs. Virtually all artists encounter such moments. Fear that your next work will fail is a normal, recurring, and generally healthy part of the art-making cycle. It happens all the time. You focus on some new idea in your work. You try it out, run with it for a while, reach a point of diminishing returns, and eventually decide it's not worth pursuing further. Writers even have a phrase for it. The pen has run dry. But all media have their equivalents. In the normal artistic cycle, this just tells you that you've come full circle, back to that point where you need to begin cultivating the next new idea. But in artistic death, it marks the last thing that happens. You play out an idea, it stops working, you put the brush down, and 30 years later you confide to someone over coffee that, well, yes, you had wanted to paint when you were much younger. Quitting is fundamentally different from stopping. The latter happens all the time. Quitting happens once. Quitting means not starting again. And art is all about starting again. A second universal moment of truth for artists appears when the destination for the work is suddenly withdrawn. For veteran artists, this moment usually coincides. Rather perversely, we feel, with reaching that destination. The authors recall a mutual friend whose single-minded quest for 20 years was to land a one-man show at his city's major art museum. He finally got it, and never produced a serious piece of art again. There's a painful irony to stories like that, to discovering how frequently and easily success transmutes into depression. Avoiding this fate has something to do with not letting your current goal become your only goal. With individual artworks, it means leaving some loose thread, some unresolved issue, to carry forward and explore in the next piece. With larger goals, like monographs or major shows, it means always carrying within you the seed crystal for your next destination. And for a few physically risky art forms, like dance, it may even mean keeping an alternative medium close by, in case age or injury take you from your chosen work. For art students, losing the destination for the work goes by another name, graduation. Ask any student, for how many before them was the graduate show the terminal show? When the critique is the only validated destination for work made during the first half-decade of an artist's productive life, small wonder that attrition rates spiral when that path stops. If 98% of our medical students were no longer practicing medicine 5 years after graduation, there would be a Senate investigation. Yet that proportion of art majors are routinely consigned to an early professional death. Not many people continue making art when, abruptly, their work is no longer seen, no longer exhibited, no longer commented upon, no longer encouraged. Could you? Surprisingly, the dropout rate during school is not all that high. The real killer is the lack of any continuing support system afterwards. Perhaps then, if the outside world shows little interest in providing that support, it remains for artists themselves to do so. Viewed that way, a strategy suggests itself. Operating manual for not quitting. A. Make friends with others who make art, and share your in-progress work with each other frequently. B. Learn to think of A, rather than the Museum of Modern Art, as the destination of your work. Look at it this way. If all goes well, MoMA will eventually come to you. The desire to make art begins early. Among the very young, this is encouraged, or at least indulged as harmless, but the push toward a serious education soon exacts a heavy toll on dreams and fantasies. Yes, the authors really have known students whose parents demanded they stop wasting their time on art, or they could damn well pay their own tuition. Yet for some, the desire persists, and sooner or later must be addressed. And with good reason. Your desire to make art, beautiful or meaningful or emotive art, is integral to your sense of who you are. Life and art, once entwined, can quickly become inseparable. At age 90, Frank Lloyd Wright was still designing, Imogen Cunningham still photographing, Stravinsky still composing, Picasso still painting. But if making art gives substance to your sense of self, the corresponding fear is that you're not up to the task, that you can't do it, or can't do it well, or can't do it again, or that you're not a real artist, or not a good artist, or have no talent, or have nothing to say. The line between the artist and his, her work is a fine one at best, and for the artist it feels, quite naturally, like there is no such line. Making art can feel dangerous and revealing. Making art is dangerous and revealing. Making art precipitates self-doubt, stirring deep waters that lay between what you know you should be and what you fear you might be. For many people, that alone is enough to prevent their ever getting started at all. And for those who do, trouble isn't long in coming. Doubts, in fact, soon rise in swarms. I'm not an artist. I'm a phony. I have nothing worth saying. I'm not sure what I'm doing. Other people are better than I am. I'm only a student, physicist, mother, whatever. I've never had a real exhibit. No one understands my work. No one likes my work. I'm no good. Yet viewed objectively, these fears obviously have less to do with art than they do with the artist, and even less to do with individual artworks. After all, in making art, you bring your highest skills to bear upon the materials and ideas you most care about. Art is a high calling. Fears are coincidental. Coincidental, sneaky, and disruptive, we might add, disguising themselves variously as laziness, resistance to deadlines, irritation with materials or surroundings, distraction over the achievements of others, indeed as anything that keeps you from giving your work your best shot. What separates artists from ex-artists is that those who challenge their fears continue. Those who don't, quit. Each step in the art-making process puts that issue to the test. Vision and execution. Fears arise when you look back, and they arise when you look ahead. If you're prone to disaster fantasies, you may even find yourself caught in the middle, staring at your half-finished canvas and fearing both that you lack the ability to finish it and that no one will understand it if you do. More often, though, fears rise in those entirely appropriate and frequently recurring moments when vision races ahead of execution. Consider the story of the young student, well, David Bales to be exact, who began piano studies with a master. After a few months' practice, David lamented to his teacher, "But I can hear the music so much better in my head than I can get out of my fingers." To which the master replied, "What makes you think that ever changes?" That's why they're called masters. When he raised David's discovery from an expression of self-doubt to a simple observation of reality, uncertainty became an asset. Lesson for the day: vision is always ahead of execution, and it should be. Vision, uncertainty, and knowledge of materials are inevitabilities that all artists must acknowledge and learn from. Vision is always ahead of execution. Knowledge of materials is your contact with reality, and uncertainty is a virtue. Imagination. Imagination is in control when you begin making an object. The artwork's potential is never higher than in that magic moment when the first brushstroke is applied, the first chord struck. But as the piece grows, technique and craft take over, and imagination becomes a less useful tool. A piece grows by becoming specific. The moment Herman Melville penned the opening line, "Call me Ishmael," one actual story, Moby Dick, began to separate itself from a multitude of imaginable others. And so on through the following 500-odd pages, each successive sentence in some way had to acknowledge and relate to all that preceded. Joan Didion nailed this issue squarely, and with trademark pessimism, when she said, "What's so hard about that first sentence is that you're stuck with it. Everything else is going to flow out of that sentence. And by the time you've laid down the first two sentences, your options are all gone." It's the same for all media. The first few brushstrokes to the blank canvas satisfy the requirements of many possible paintings, while the last few fit only that painting. They could go nowhere else. The development of an imagined piece into an actual piece is a progression of decreasing possibilities, as each step in execution reduces future options by converting one, and only one, possibility into a reality. Finally, at some point or another, the piece could not be other than it is. And it is done. That moment of completion is also, inevitably, a moment of loss. The loss of all the other forms the imagined piece might have taken. The irony here is that the piece you make is always one step removed from what you imagined, or what else you can imagine, or what you're right on the edge of being able to imagine. Designer Charles Eames, arguably the quintessential Renaissance man of the 20th century, used to complain good-naturedly that he devoted only about 1% of his energy to conceiving a design, and the remaining 99% to holding on to it as a project ran its course. Small surprise. After all, your imagination is free to race 100 works ahead, conceiving pieces you could and perhaps should and maybe one day will execute. But not today. Not in the piece at hand. All you can work on today is directly in front of you. Your job is to develop an imagination of the possible. A finished piece is, in effect, a test of correspondence between imagination and execution. And perhaps surprisingly, the more common obstacle to achieving that correspondence is not undisciplined execution, but undisciplined imagination. It's altogether too seductive to approach your proposed work believing your materials to be more malleable than they really are, your ideas more compelling, your execution more refined. As Stanley Kunitz once commented, "The poem in the head is always perfect. Resistance begins when you try to convert it into language." And it's true. Most artists don't daydream about making great art. They daydream about having made great art. What artist has not experienced the feverish euphoria of composing the perfect thumbnail sketch, first draft, negative, or melody, only to run headlong into a stone wall trying to convert that tantalizing hint into the finished mural, novel, photograph, sonata? The artist's life is frustrating, not because the passage is slow, but because he imagines it to be fast. Materials. The materials of art, like the thumbnail sketch, seduce us with their potential. The texture of the paper, the smell of the paint, the weight of the stone, all cast hints and innuendos, beckoning our fantasies. In the presence of good materials, hopes grow and possibilities multiply. And with good reason. Some materials are so readily charged and responsive that artists have turned to them for thousands of years, and probably will for thousands more. For many artists, the response to a particular material has been intensely personal, as if the material spoke directly to them. It's been said that as a child, Pablo Casals knew from the first moment he heard the sound of a cello that that was his instrument. But where materials have potential, they also have limits. Ink wants to flow, but not across just any surface. Clay wants to hold a shape, but not just any shape. And in any case, without your active participation, their potential remains just that. Potential. Materials are like elementary particles, charged but indifferent. They do not listen in on your fantasies, do not get up and move in response to your idle wishes. The blunt truth is they do precisely what your hands make them do. The paint lays exactly where you put it. The words you wrote, not the ones you needed to write or thought about writing, are the only ones that appear on the page. In the words of Ben Shahn, the painter who stands before an empty canvas must think in terms of paint. What counts in making art is the actual fit between the contents of your head and the qualities of your materials. The knowledge you need to make that fit comes from noticing what really happens as you work, the way the materials respond, and the way that response and resistance suggest new ideas to you. It's those real and ordinary changes that matter. Art is about carrying things out, and materials are what can be carried out. Because they are real, they are reliable. Uncertainty. Your materials are, in fact, one of the few elements of art making you can reasonably hope to control. As for everything else, well, conditions are never perfect, sufficient knowledge rarely at hand, key evidence always missing, and support notoriously fickle. All that you do will inevitably be flavored with uncertainty. Uncertainty about what you have to say, about whether the materials are right, about whether the piece should be long or short, indeed, about whether you'll ever be satisfied with anything you make. Photographer Jerry Uhlsman once gave a slide lecture in which he showed every single image he had created in the span of 1 year, some 100-odd pieces, all but about 10 of which he judged insufficient and destroyed without ever exhibiting. Tolstoy, in The Age Before Typewriters, rewrote War and Peace 8 times and was still revising galley proofs as it finally rolled onto the press. William Kennedy gamely admitted that he rewrote his own novel, Legs, 8 times, and that 7 times it came out no good. 6 times, it was especially no good. The 7th time it was pretty good, though it was way too long. My son was 6 years old by then, and so was my novel, and they were both about the same height. It is, in short, the normal state of affairs. The truth is that the piece of art which seems so profoundly right in its finished state may earlier have been only inches or seconds away from total collapse. Lincoln doubted his capacity to express what needed to be said at Gettysburg, yet pushed ahead anyway, knowing he was doing the best he could to present the ideas he needed to share. It's always like that. Art is like beginning a sentence before you know its ending. The risks are obvious. You may never get to the end of the sentence at all, or, having gotten there, you may not have said anything. This is probably not a good idea in public speaking, but it's an excellent idea in making art. In making art, you need to give yourself room to respond authentically, both to your subject matter and to your materials. Art happens between you and something, a subject, an idea, a technique, and both you and that something need to be free to move. Many fiction writers, for instance, discover early on that making detailed plot outlines is an exercise in futility. As actual writing progresses, characters increasingly take on a life of their own, sometimes to the point that the writer is as surprised as the eventual reader by what their creations say and do. Lawrence Durrell likened the process to driving construction stakes in the ground. You plant a stake, run 50 yards ahead, plant another, and pretty soon you know which way the road will run. E.M. Forster recalled that when he began writing A Passage to India, he knew that the Malabar Caves would play a central role in the novel, that something important would surely happen there. It's just that he wasn't sure what it would be. Control, apparently, is not the answer. People who need certainty in their lives are less likely to make art that is risky, subversive, complicated, iffy, suggestive, or spontaneous. What's really needed is nothing more than a broad sense of what you were looking for, some strategy for how to find it, and an overriding willingness to embrace mistakes and surprises along the way. Simply put, making art is chancy. It doesn't mix well with predictability. Uncertainty is the essential, inevitable, and all-pervasive companion to your desire to make art. And tolerance for uncertainty is the prerequisite to succeeding. 3. Fears about yourself. We have met the enemy, and he is us. Pogo. Ahead lies a broad expanse of river, flowing rapidly. The oarsman, only recently learning his skill, nervously maneuvers to avoid the one and only rock breaking the surface downstream, dead center, smooth current to either side. You watch from shore. The oarsman zigs left, zigs right, and then crashes directly into the rock. When you act out of fear, your fears come true. Fears about art making fall into two families, fears about yourself and fears about your reception by others. In a general way, fears about yourself prevent you from doing your best work, while fears about your reception by others prevent you from doing your own work. Both families surface in many forms, some of which you may find all too familiar. Try this sampler. Pretending. The fear that you're only pretending to do art is the readily predictable consequence of doubting your own artistic credentials. After all, you know better than anyone else the accidental nature of much that appears in your art, not to mention all those elements you know originated with others, and even some you never even intended but which the audience has read into your work. From there, it's only a short hop to feeling like you're just going through the motions of being an artist. It's easy to imagine that real artists know what they're doing, and that they, unlike you, are entitled to feel good about themselves and their art. Fear that you are not a real artist causes you to undervalue your work. The chasm widens even further when your work isn't going well, when happy accidents aren't happening or hunches aren't paying off. If you buy into the premise that art can be made only by people who are extraordinary, such down periods only serve to confirm that you aren't. Before chucking it all for a day job, however, consider the dynamics at work here. Both making art and viewing art require an ongoing investment of energy. Lots of energy. In moments of weakness, the myth of the extraordinary provides the excuse for an artist to quit trying to make art, and the excuse for a viewer to quit trying to understand it. Meanwhile, artists who do continue often become perilously self-conscious about their art-making. If you doubt this could be a problem, just try working intuitively or spontaneously while self-consciously weighing the effect of your every action. The increasing prevalence of reflexive art, art that looks inward, taking itself as its subject, may to some degree simply illustrate attempts by artists to turn this obstacle to their advantage. Art that's about art has in turn spawned a whole school of art criticism built around the demonstrably true, but limited, premise that artists continually redefine art through their work. This approach treats what art is as a legitimate, serious, and even thorny topic, but expends little energy on the question of what art making is. Clearly, something's come unbalanced here. After all, if there were some ongoing redefinition of what chess is, you'd probably feel a little uneasy trying to play chess. Of course, you could always stick with the game by limiting yourself to a few easy moves you've seen work for others. Then again, you might conclude that since you weren't sure yourself what chess was, you weren't a real chess player, and were only faking it when you moved the pieces around. You might secretly come to believe that you deserve to lose. In fact, you might even quit playing entirely. If the preceding scenario sounds far-fetched vis-à-vis chess, it remains discouragingly common vis-à-vis art. But while you may feel you're just pretending that you're an artist, there's no way to pretend you're making art. Go ahead. Try writing a story while pretending you're writing a story. Not possible. Your work may not be what curators want to exhibit or publishers want to publish, but those are different issues entirely. You make good work by, among other things, making lots of work that isn't very good, and gradually weeding out the parts that aren't good, the parts that aren't yours. It's called feedback, and it's the most direct route to learning about your own vision. It's also called doing your work. After all, someone has to do your work, and you're the closest person around. Talent. Talent, in common parlance, is what comes easily. So, sooner or later, inevitably, you reach a point where the work doesn't come easily and, aha, it's just as you feared. Wrong. By definition, whatever you have is exactly what you need to produce your best work. There is probably no clearer waste of psychic energy than worrying about how much talent you have, and probably no worry more common. This is even true among artists of considerable accomplishment. Talent, if it is anything, is a gift, and nothing of the artist's own making. This idea is hardly new. Plato maintained that all art is a gift from the gods, channeled through artists who are out of their mind, quite literally in Plato's view, when making art. Plato, however, is not the only philosopher on the block. While his description correlates well with the functioning of the oracle at Delphi, idiot savants, and certain TV evangelists, it's difficult to reconcile with most real-world events. Were talent a prerequisite, then the better the artwork, the easier it would have been to make. But alas, the fates are rarely so generous. For every artist who has developed a mature vision with grace and speed, countless others have laboriously nurtured their art through fertile periods and dry spells, through false starts and breakaway bursts, through successive and significant changes of direction, medium, and subject matter. Talent may get someone off the starting blocks faster, but without a sense of direction or a goal to strive for, it won't count for much. The world is filled with people who were given great natural gifts, sometimes conspicuously flashy gifts, yet never produce anything. And when that happens, the world soon ceases to care whether they are talented. For even at best, talent remains a constant. And those who rely upon that gift alone, without developing further, peak quickly and soon fade to obscurity. Examples of genius only accentuate that truth. Newspapers love to print stories about 5-year-old musical prodigies giving solo recitals, but you rarely read about one going on to become a Mozart. The point here is that whatever his initial gift, Mozart was also an artist who learned to work on his work, and thereby improved. In that respect, he shares common ground with the rest of us. Artists get better by sharpening their skills or by acquiring new ones. They get better by learning to work, and by learning from their work. They commit themselves to the work of their heart and act upon that commitment. So when you ask, then why doesn't it come easily for me? The answer is probably because making art is hard. What you end up caring about is what you do, not whether the doing came hard or easy. Talent is a snare and a delusion. In the end, the practical questions about talent come down to these. Who cares? Who would know? And what difference would it make? And the practical answers are nobody, nobody, and none. A brief digression in which the authors attempt to answer or deflect an objection. Question. Aren't you ignoring the fact that people differ radically in their abilities? Answer. No. Question. But if people differ, and each of them were to make their best work, would not the more gifted make better work, and the less gifted less? Answer. Yes. And wouldn't that be a nice planet to live on? Perfection. The ceramics teacher announced on opening day that he was dividing the class into two groups. All those in the left side of the studio, he said, would be graded solely on the quantity of work they produced, all those on the right solely on its quality. His procedure was simple. On the final day of class, he would bring in his bathroom scales and weigh the work of the quantity group, 50 pounds of pots rated an A, 40 pounds of B, and so on. Those being graded on quality, however, needed to produce only one pot, albeit a perfect one, to get an A. Well, came grading time, and a curious fact emerged. The works of highest quality were all produced by the group being graded for quantity. It seems that while the quantity group was busily churning out piles of work and learning from their mistakes, the quality group had sat theorizing about perfection, and in the end had little more to show for their efforts than grandiose theories and a pile of dead clay. If you think good work is somehow synonymous with perfect work, you are headed for big trouble. Art is human. Error is human. Ergo, art is error. Inevitably, your work, like the preceding syllogism, will be flawed. Why? Because you're a human being, and only human beings, warts and all, make art. Without warts, it is not clear what you would be, but clearly, you wouldn't be one of us. Nonetheless, the belief persists among some artists, and lots of ex-artists, that doing art means doing things flawlessly, ignoring the fact that this prerequisite would disqualify most existing works of art. Indeed, it seems vastly more plausible to advance the counter-principle, namely that imperfection is not only a common ingredient in art, but very likely an essential ingredient. Ansel Adams, never one to mistake precision for perfection, often recalled the old adage that the perfect is the enemy of the good. His point being that if he waited for everything in the scene to be exactly right, he'd probably never make a photograph. Adams was right. To require perfection is to invite paralysis. The pattern is predictable. As you see error in what you have done, you steer your work toward what you imagine you can do perfectly. You cling ever more tightly to what you already know you can do, away from risk and exploration, and possibly further from the work of your heart. You find reasons to procrastinate, since to not work is not to make mistakes. Believing that artwork should be perfect, you gradually become convinced that you cannot make such work. You are correct. Sooner or later, since you cannot do what you were trying to do, you quit. And in one of those perverse little ironies of life, only the pattern itself achieves perfection. A perfect death spiral. You misdirect your work. You stall. You quit. To demand perfection is to deny your ordinary and universal humanity, as though you would be better off without it. Yet this humanity is the ultimate source of your work. Your perfectionism denies you the very thing you need to get your work done. Getting on with your work requires a recognition that perfection itself is, paradoxically, a flawed concept. For Albert Einstein, even the seemingly perfect construct of mathematics yielded to his observation that, as far as the laws of mathematics refer to reality, they are not certain. And as far as they are certain, they do not refer to reality. For Charles Darwin, evolution lay revealed when a perfect survival strategy for one generation became, in a changing world, a liability for its offspring. For you, the seed for your next artwork lies embedded in the imperfections of your current piece. Such imperfections, or mistakes if you're feeling particularly depressed about them today, are your guides. Valuable, reliable, objective, non-judgmental guides to matters you need to reconsider or develop further. It is precisely this interaction between the ideal and the real that locks your art into the real world and gives meaning to both. Annihilation. For most artists, hitting a dry spell in their art-making would be a serious blow. For a few, it would amount to annihilation. Some artists identify so closely with their own work that were they to cease producing, they fear they would be nothing, that they would cease existing. In the words of John Barth, it's Scheherazade's terror, the terror that comes from the literal or metaphorical equating of telling stories with living, with life itself. I understand that metaphor to the marrow of my bones. Some avoid this self-imposed abyss by becoming stupendously productive, churning out work in quantities that surprise even close friends, and positively unnerve envious peers. They work passionately, as if they were possessed. And wouldn't you too, if that were all that kept the Reaper at bay? Others, no less driven, project instead a certain no-nonsense professionalism, precise, relentless, and narrowly aimed at making art, which, indeed, they may be very good at. History records that Anthony Trollope methodically drafted exactly 49 pages of manuscript a week, 7 pages a day, and was so obsessed with keeping to that schedule that if he finished a novel in the morning, he'd pen the title for his next book on a new sheet and plod relentlessly ahead until he completed his quota for the day. And from personal experience, the authors can verify that Brett Weston, a virtual case study in annihilation, for decades maintained in his home an ongoing exhibition of a dozen or more of his photographs, none of which was ever more than 6 months old. Still, there must be many fates worse than the inability to stop producing art. The artist who fears annihilation may draw the connection between doing and being a little too tight. But this is really just a case of having too much of a good thing. Annihilation is an existential fear. The common, but sharply overdrawn, fear that some part of you dies when you stop making art. And it's true. Non-artists may not understand that, but artists themselves, especially those who are stuck, understand it all too well. The depth of your need to make things establishes the level of risk in not making them. Magic. There's a myth among amateurs, optimists, and fools, that beyond a certain level of achievement, famous artists retire to some kind of Elysium, where criticism no longer wounds, and work materializes without their effort. Mark Matusik. In a darkened theater, the man in the tuxedo waves his hand and a pigeon appears. We call it magic. In a sunlit studio, a painter waves her hand and a whole world takes form. We call it art. Sometimes the difference isn't all that clear. Imagine you've just attended an exhibition and seen work that's powerful and coherent, work that has range and purpose. The artist's statement framed near the door is clear. These works materialized exactly as the artist conceived them. The work is inevitable. But wait a minute. Your work doesn't feel inevitable, you think. And so you begin to wonder, maybe making art requires some special or even magic ingredient that you don't have. The belief that real art possesses some indefinable magic ingredient puts pressure on you to prove your work contains the same. Wrong. Very wrong. Asking your work to prove anything only invites doom. Besides, if artists share any common view of magic, it is probably the fatalistic suspicion that when their own art turns out well, it's a fluke. But when it turns out poorly, it's an omen. Buying into magic leaves you feeling less capable each time another artist's qualities are praised. So if a critic praises Nabokov's obsession with wordplay, you begin to worry that you can't even spell obsession. If Christo's love of process is championed, you feel guilty that you've always hated cleaning your brushes. If some art historian comments that great art is the product of especially fertile times and places, you begin to think maybe you need to move to New York. Admittedly, art-making probably does require something special, but just what that something might be has remained remarkably elusive. Elusive enough to suggest that it may be something particular to each artist, rather than universal to them all. Or even, perhaps, that it's all nothing more than the art world's variation on the emperor's new suit of clothes. But the important point here is not that you have or don't have what other artists have, but rather that it doesn't matter. Whatever they have is something needed to do their work. It wouldn't help you in your work even if you had it. Their magic is theirs. You don't lack it. You don't need it. It has nothing to do with you. Period. Expectations. Hovering out there somewhere between cause and effect, between fears about self and fears about others, lie expectations. Being one of the higher brain functions, as our neocortex modestly calls itself, expectations provide a means to merge imagination with calculation. But it's a delicate balance. Lean too far one way and your head fills with unworkable fantasies, too far the other and you spend your life generating to-do lists. Worse yet, expectations drift into fantasies all too easily. At a recent writer's workshop, the instructor labored heroically to keep the discussion centered upon issues of craft, as yet unlearned, while the writers, as yet unpublished, labored equally to divert the focus with questions about royalties, movie rights, and sequels. Given a small kernel of reality and any measure of optimism, nebulous expectations whisper to you that the work will soar, that it will become easy, that it will make itself. And verily, now and then the sky opens and the work does make itself. Unreal expectations are easy to come by, both from emotional needs and from the hope or memory of periods of wonder. Unfortunately, expectations based on illusion lead almost always to disillusionment. Conversely, expectations based on the work itself are the most useful tool the artist possesses. What you need to know about the next piece is contained in the last piece. The place to learn about your materials is in the last use of your materials. The place to learn about your execution is in your execution. The best information about what you love is in your last contact with what you love. Put simply, your work is your guide. A complete, comprehensive, limitless reference book on your work. There is no other such book, and it is yours alone. It functions this way for no one else. Your fingerprints are all over your work, and you alone know how they got there. Your work tells you about your working methods, your discipline, your strengths and weaknesses, your habitual gestures, your willingness to embrace. The lessons you are meant to learn are in your work. To see them, you need only look at the work clearly, without judgment, without need or fear, without wishes or hopes, without emotional expectations. Ask your work what it needs, not what you need. Then set aside your fears and listen, the way a good parent listens to a child. 4. Fears about others. Don't look back. Something might be gaining on you. Satchel Paige. Art is often made in abandonment, emerging unbidden in moments of selfless rapport with the materials and ideas we care about. In such moments we leave no space for others. That's probably as it should be. Art, after all, rarely emerges from committees. But while others' reactions need not cause problems for the artist, they usually do. The problems arise when we confuse others' priorities with our own. We carry real and imagined critics with us constantly, a veritable babble of voices, some remembered, some prophesied, and each eager to comment on all we do. Beyond that, Even society's general notions about art-making confront the artist with paralyzing contradictions. As an artist, you're expected to make each successive piece uniquely new and different, yet reassuringly familiar when set alongside your earlier work. You're expected to make art that's innately, perhaps even painfully, personal